Welcome to the BMT Sustainability Podcast with me, Del Redvers, Sustainability Director at BMT.
And me, Laura Blake. As Head of Sustainability, I've supported BMT's sustainability agenda for 7 years and have dedicated my career to driving sustainable development and responsible business practices.
We have a shared interest in the complexity of shaping a better world. And together, this is our first experience of delivering a podcast.
We're super excited to give this a go and hugely appreciate you being with us on this journey, exploring the diverse and dynamic world of sustainability as we work to deliver purpose-led change.
Our world is full of complex and interconnected challenges, where it isn't always possible to reduce ideas to a single soundbite or statistic, and often where there isn't an objectively right or wrong answer. We want to talk to people across our business to get their ideas on sustainability-related topics, and in doing so, to improve our thinking as a business.
This podcast is our attempt to do just that. In each episode, we will explore different ways of looking at a wide range of challenging topics, prompting us to think critically and stay open to change.
So, thank you for listening, and let's get started.
Hello and welcome to today's podcast. In this episode, we will dive into the double-edged nature of technology and how it acts as both a catalyst and a barrier for purpose-led organisations like ours. This is front of mind for our sustainability team as we increasingly integrate digital technology at the centre of our business and use it as a tool to support our net zero journey. Today, I'm joined by my co-host, Del Redvers, and our guest, Simon Wilmore, who is Digital Transformations Director at BMT. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
So before we delve into this topic, I'd like to start today by asking you to tell us about a sustainability challenge in the digital technology space at the moment that is keeping you up at night.
Oh, wow. It's quite a lot of things you hear in the press about the the energy usage for certain activities. You know, artificial intelligence or, you know, AI has been all over the media now for the last couple of years. I think the press that technology gets from an environmental point of view is really negative. And I think rightly so. But I think often as well, you know, the opportunity that comes potentially with the technology or changing some of the practices behind AI can actually make it more sustainable in the long run.
Del, is this something that resonates with you? Is this something that you're concerned about?
Yeah, I think the energy challenge for sure is, and there's a lot to explore. The thing that keeps me up about AI at night is how little I know and understand about it. So I'm really glad Simon's here. But I genuinely feel much more optimistic than pessimistic. I feel there's more things that keep me up at night being excited about the potential application than keep me up at night worrying about how terrible it might be or the problems. But that said, there are some issues to overcome. One, my big issue at the moment in AI I've got to deal with is that I made one of my kids an AI birthday card with them as their favourite hero, and it worked brilliantly. And I have the pressure to do it for the other kid, and I can't work out how to make it as good in their eyes. So that's my AI challenge right now, which is making me feel quite anxious.
Something that's concerning me about this huge topic is 3 or 4 years ago, I read that data storage was taking up 2-3% of our global energy usage worldwide. And since that time, we've had the pandemic and then we've seen the rise of AI and the usage of this technology. And I don't really know how much that's increased in terms of our global greenhouse gas emissions.
I know that over the last sort of 50 years or so of computing, you know, the global footprint of storage, you know, has increased at an absolutely, you know, exponential rate. And it continues to do so into the future, which is why a lot of interest in the last decade and a half have been around kind of the introduction of cloud computing and cloud storage. And really that was kind of being driven by the increasing amounts of storage or processing that people were expecting to have in their daily life. So most people have got, you know, a smartphone probably listening to this. And if you just think now that when I was a child, you'd be on holiday, you get your Polaroid camera out, you snap your 25 pictures, you wouldn't know that any of them had worked until the end. So you'd only take one picture of whatever you were taking a picture of. Now we wander around, you know, the local supermarket, and our wife will probably take 30, 40 photos without thinking of what she's doing. And all of that doesn't get saved on her phone. All of it gets stored, you know, somewhere else as well. So there's sort of a convenience factor to data, you know, which has driven this kind of massive explosion of storage. And I think from a business point of view, that's been beneficial in many ways. I think it's a lot easier now to access past projects or past, you know, design information than it would have been going back through kind of hard files. But the kind of flip side though is that we probably also aren't as good as we used to be at weeding stuff out and throwing out the things we don't need. And because it's now so easy and accessible just to store and hoard more and more information, it all ends up being sacked somewhere. And as I've said, increasingly, the trend has been to put this into someone else's storage, into a cloud storage. But all that comes at a cost. You know, anything where there's a monetary cost, there's probably an environmental cost, you know, somewhere in there as well.
What I want to know is what's so interesting in Simon's local supermarket. I couldn't think of 30 or 40 photos to be taken in a supermarket for that. But not wanting to be good about it, but isn't the challenge, I recognise the challenge of, you know, we all take loads of photos and so it all builds up. But isn't there an AI solution to that at some point? Is that not just going to be fixed by the technology itself, and that it'll look at, like, you put four photos of the same thing up here, we're only going to save one, delete the other, it'll just be a setting you can put on your phone, the best one stays, or in fact all four merge and make the best possible image of the one you've got, and everything else gets deleted and the data problem's kind of solved?
So the easiest way to think about cloud infrastructure is that it's somebody else's computer. All you're doing is, rather than running, keeping your information on your laptop, maybe in a server buried away in the back office of your office that you're in, you're just aggregating lots and lots and lots of companies' worth of infrastructure into sort of a massive, massive data center, they call it. And these things are typically absolutely huge. And so whilst we call it the cloud, it makes it feel like it's kind of zipping around in the air somewhere. They're not. They're physical locations, you know, dotted around the world. And, you know, for Microsoft alone, they've got two big ones here in the UK. And they are just essentially massive storage and computer centers. And what people are doing is they're basically aggregating their storage and their processing that they would have had in their offices into someone else's offices. And they're connecting to it via telephone lines, via mobile phone networks, kind of. So they're leveraging somebody else's connectivity. Because if you think back to, let's say, even 20 years ago, you know, in a company like BMT, you would have gone to work. You probably more likely had a desktop 20 years ago. It would have been hardwired into something in the office that would have been hardwired into a server room that you probably never saw and never went to. And that server room is turned on 24/7. 365 days a year. So on Christmas morning, when hopefully no one's logged on checking their emails, there is a server somewhere that was still on, because actually typically it was more difficult to turn these things off and restart than it was to leave them on. So it used to be, as we used to, you know, say in the trade here, turning and burning, generating heat, using electricity, needing air conditioning to be running all the time to keep that server room cool enough to keep operating, because if it got too hot, things would break. What you'd also find was that in the last 20 years or so, you've even been able to think about accessing your files, wherever they are, from somewhere outside of your office. And, you know, most of us probably didn't really think through that kind of transition from, you know, having to be in a fixed location to do your work to suddenly, oh, now I can be somewhere else. And maybe it's a bit slow and it's not very convenient, but it was possible to start accessing your files whilst you're remote. And then all of a sudden, almost subliminally, now I can access from anywhere. I can sit in my spare bedroom. I can sit on the train on the way in this morning. I can be in the office. I can be in my hotel tonight. And I've got complete access to everything I could possibly want at my fingertips to do with how I work. All of my files, all of the computing power I could possibly need. And all of that's because we're not reliant on a server in the back end of an office in BMT somewhere. We're now making use of this massive infrastructure that, say, Microsoft have put in place called cloud services. And that's what cloud services are. Is you're putting your information into someone else's infrastructure. And if you're just putting the things in that you use every day, like your Word documents, your PowerPoint, your emails, then actually cloud services are massively more efficient than running it ourselves. And it makes perfect sense when you think about it. You know, if you concentrate huge amounts of infrastructure together, the per unit running cost is probably going to be a bit less. Their ability to invest in really efficient cooling solutions, far more so than our air conditioning can cope with, are better. So per unit of, say, storage or processing, cloud storage is far, far better. And now I want to get on to kind of Dell's point about, well, why don't you just use an AI to weed out all your photographs? So I've now got thousands and thousands and thousands of photographs in the cloud. And yeah, absolutely. The cloud gives me access to infrastructure and computing software, computing hardware and software that I just don't have at home. So yeah, there probably is now an AI that can look over my 50,000 photos of my cat and decide on the best 20 of them. But that's an activity that I couldn't have done before. So whilst it might be efficient at reducing storage, there's been a huge investment in energy to create an AI model that's capable of weeding out cat pictures and weeding out pictures around your shopping trip or whatever. And so this is where the downside of cloud computing comes from. If you do like-for-like things, it's really, really efficient, like 95% plus efficient from what Microsoft tell us for our usage. But if you start to do things that you couldn't do in the office, like running huge AI models, suddenly you're now capable of doing something quite damaging that you couldn't do before, even if the outcome's good.
So what's the real incentive for organizations to only use data for the same things that they've always done? I mean, many organizations like Amazon Web Services aren't just storing data, are they? I mean, they're also finding ways to use it and make money from it. So is the main goal to be more efficient, or is there something else going on here?
Yeah, so I think the way that it's being addressed, certainly the way we're looking at it, is that whilst we get like emissions information about our usage, cause and effect of that, what are we doing that's causing that emission is quite hard to pin together. We can look at kind of the macro scale usage of using these cloud services, it's having this impact. I think what is easier to track today, is the financial impact of doing stuff, because ultimately, we have to pay for anything that uses up a resource. And in the form of cloud computing, the resource is typically the time and the energy spent to do something at the time. So one of the reasons why businesses kind of sometimes look favorably on cloud services as opposed to doing it yourself is that if we need to go and replace a server somewhere, I might have to go and spend a couple of £100,000 of real money right now to replace something. And that might last 5 years. And in 5 years, I've got to replace it again. But actually in cloud services, I can make that entirely an operating cost. And I can pay 5p every time I do something. Now, if I do something a couple of million times, it's probably going to cost me more than the capital investment. So what we do typically with a lot of our cloud services is that we look at the financial running cost of doing something. And if suddenly we're doing something today, that means that maybe, take our data warehouse. So we look at it several times a week. And if we suddenly spot that we've started doing something and now the cost is going to be more, well, it doesn't take a great engineering mind to realize that's probably going to have bigger environmental impact than it did before. So what did we do? What's caused that change in our usage and our behavior? And sometimes we have to look at that and go, okay, we've done something. It's more effective as a solution, but it's less efficient. So do we want to do that? And then we can take action then to stop what we're doing. Well, the main way that we can look at that ourselves today is really looking through that kind of financial lens. And I think that that's what a lot of companies that are investing in these sort of more sustainable cloud solutions are really going after, is the fact that if they're more sustainable to run, lower electricity costs, maybe lower cooling costs in some way, maybe less water usage, maybe it costs them less to run. Therefore, then the price to the consumer at the end, whether that's a business or an individual, is less as well. And if you look at the trends over the last few years, the running costs of a lot of these services have continued to decrease over time.
Yeah, well, so it's interesting. At that point, I came across a statistic recently that said up to 70% of corporate IT scope 3 emissions are going to be dependent on clouds of carbonisation. So getting rid of those scope 3 emissions are going to rely on the cloud computing companies to get rid of it. But the question I want to put back to you, Tom, that is the energy cost and the environment cost, or let me frame it slightly other way, use if we pay for the resources that we have to use. And I like that idea that we should. I contest that we generally don't. Otherwise, ecosystem services would be costed into most of our services. But if we pay for the resources we use, then Do you think at the moment the nature and climate costs of storage and data processing are properly costed into the business models? Because at the point of use, it seems to me like if I open a Google account just now, it will cost me nothing to do that, and that will come with some data storage capability that I pay nothing for. And I get it's part of a bigger picture, and they're not being utterly philanthropic, and there are other ways my money will get into the system. But there, at that point of use of decision making, doesn't cost me a penny. And every time right now I take a photo, doesn't cost me a penny to say that. I've got no consciousness of that financial transaction. Does that economic model work, and does it have to change?
I think it has to change, and I think this is there's a point in this about, you know, who drives the change in sort of leadership, because I think that the real challenge we get is between being consumers and being businesses, because I think that in reality the business usage far dwarfs the personal, you know, usage of an individual. You know, and there's it's probably unlikely that I can take enough cat pictures to have a bigger impact than, say, you know, even a small business. So, and it's that challenge about, you know, where, who do you tax with the impact of the cloud services? Do you go after businesses? Do you go after the infrastructure provider? Do you add a bit more onto the, you know, the tax for an individual? So it's interesting that yours is free, because I have to pay a couple of pounds a month to Apple just because our storage ran out. And what we've sort of noticed on that sort of trend is that actually they always seem to not have the, you know, the storage account for the amount you actually need. You always have to go up one to an increasingly bigger level. So I think our relationship with that, you know, has to change, because what's also kind of not one thing we've not covered though as well is that, you know, hardware doesn't last forever. You know, even these big data centers needs to be replaced. There's only actually, you know, even without the environmental point of view, there's only a finite, you know, supply, you know, on Earth for some of these materials anyway. And all of that doesn't quite feel entirely factored into the kind of the economic case, you know, as a consumer.
Yeah,
I see.
Do you feel when you have to pay more for the increase in amount of storage you need, as a consumer, you're educated on why that is? Is it because of the environment? The reason I ask this is I think of some really good schemes that we've seen across the world, like the plastic bag tax. And I think on many levels, this was a brilliant way to educate people about the environmental impact. And I'm sure if that was removed today, we'd still see less people using plastic bags. But my gut feeling is that, okay, people are having to pay more for storage, but I don't necessarily see the link to the environmental impact. And I'm not sure whether the education piece is there for consumers.
Yeah, and I think that's a really interesting point, because I think the... So if you take plastic bags, I don't know if the use of plastic bags was, you know, in say the UK was increasing, you know, exponentially. And even if it was increasing, you know, in line with, you know, GDP or population growth or something, you know, it was probably a fairly linear increase. The challenge with technology is that the growth is exponential or beyond exponential. So in, you know, when I was doing my electronics degree, we used to talk a lot about this idea of this thing called Moore's Law. And basically, Moore's Law said that every 18 months, computers get twice as fast. And you think, what else in nature, or, you know, extends at quite that speed? And this is part of the problem I find with technology, and even being able to say, you know, has storage got more expensive? Because actually, storage has got exponentially cheaper as time has gone on. You know, when I was 10, we had a computer at home which had a 40 megabyte hard drive. You know, the Apollo 11 capsule had 64 kilobytes, I think, of storage that landed on the moon. You know, my iPhone, I don't know what it's called, 128 gigabytes. That's thousands and thousands of times more storage than we had previously. But it costs a whole lot less than my, you know, 1980s desktop personal computer did. And so it's really difficult. And I think it makes it really hard for consumers or even businesses to really be able to understand the cost and the impact of things. Because, you know, as technologies improve, the prices have dropped so rapidly.
Yeah.
But now we end up in a situation, I think, where we need to look really carefully at our usage. Because there is storing 15 versions of the same document, version 1, version 2, version 1 with my comments, version 1 with Dell's comments. The 3 emails will be shared the same document again. You wouldn't have done it if they were all hard copies. But yet we are now kind of creating an environment where there is such a kind of lot of digital waste that because it's cheap, we're kind of missing out the fact that there is actually an impact to having this. So one impact you could say from an employee point of view is I just can't find anything because there's so many versions of the same thing. How do I know what the good bit is? But of course, all of this at some time or another is dependent on hardware that will be replaced, hardware that needs to be cool, or electricity that goes into making that searchable again by the AI or the employee when they're rooting around in a network drive somewhere, or when the cloud services providers are shunting our data around the network to allow for a bit of maintenance to happen or for business resilience. And all these things all take energy. They all take a bit of resources to do.
So I think this is really intriguing that we're getting used to, people have realized that when they want to sell stuff to us, if you take the pain of paying away, you get a lot more money in the end. And so dissociating the act of paying from the thing you're doing. And therefore stuff feels free at the point of use a lot more than it used to do. And it's hard enough to persuade somebody that actually your actions matter when it comes to making a decision about whether or not to get on a plane and take a flight. It is going to be way much harder to persuade someone that their much less impactful action matters at the point of clicking a mouse, just to click save or not to click save. I think that's going to be a really big challenge. But on the data and the complexity of how we make decisions and how we get people to make the right choice, on a positive note, I came across something that IKEA are doing where they're using some form of artificial intelligence to essentially analyze their environmental impact of their catalog and social impact of their portfolio of products and allow customers to say, I care about the following issues to more or less, greater or lesser degrees, and then have the IKEA product catalog filtered on that basis. So I really care about climate change, sustainable forestry and slavery. Okay. Which of this stuff should I be buying and which should I not be paying any attention to? And I think that can be, maybe there's an AI solution to help us with all these decisions about, well, should I save it here or should I not save it here? Should I take a plastic bag or say two plastic bags or one of the bag for life? Should I, option A or option B, which we face all the way across the sustainability agenda. Maybe there's a positive side to this too.
So if I hear you correctly, it's maybe not worrying too much about the environmental impact of the technology at hand. It's thinking about the value of the differences the technology can make when you apply it.
Well, I think that's right. Because we've got the tools to solve the environmental impact of the technology at hand. Because the environmental impact of the technology at hand is about, fundamentally, it's about three things. It's about energy use. It's about cooling, which is just another manifestation of energy use, frankly. I mean, I know it's got water extraction and biodiversity impacts, but it's fundamentally another manifestation of energy use. And it's about the natural materials, as Simon said earlier, that are involved in the production of the hardware. And we've got actions and plans as a society for dealing with all of those things. So the question, I think, is about scalability and can we scale those things at the pace to keep in line with the scale of the technology in the industry?
I think that's right. I think the opportunity behind some of the various technologies is probably worth digging into a little bit as well. And I think that one of the reasons why I think technology always looks like kind of a bit of the bogeyman in the sort of the background on topics like this is that you don't really notice the pace of change until you stop and think back over it. And you think back that, even like 15 years ago, like who had an iPhone? Who even imagined 25 years ago, you can even have a colour screen. You're just seeing all the Vodafone 40th anniversary adverts, and it's quite reminiscent. Seeing the what did your Nokia phone look like back in the late 90s compared to what you've got today. And that I think there's always a bit of an arms race and a bit of a race for change in terms of what you can do today versus how that benefits you. And I think that particularly in the computing space, that the gains made in flexible working, supporting organizations that operate in different ways, from an ethical point of view, I think it's probably largely been quite positive. There certainly are things that exist today which probably couldn't have existed 10, 20 years ago, particularly at scale. And if anything, you know, what technology is doing is actually allowing the complexity of the choices available to be understood kind of a very, you know, real and meaningful way. Like you probably couldn't have argued in your local supermarket a few years ago, you know, how would I even done it 10 years ago? Asked the question, well, do I take three bags or do I get my, you know, slightly tougher plastic bag for life? You know, what's the better solution? Well, I think even until probably the last, you know, few years or so, where I can now go and ask like a generative AI app, like, hey, look, you know, this is probably not something I can just Google unless somebody's happened to have written a paper on it already and I can read it fast enough to get my answer. Actually, now maybe I can now start to kind of ask some intelligent questions and get an answer that helps me make a better informed decision now than I could have done previously. And I think that that's probably the next epoch of changes with technology is around kind of actually how do we engage with the computers on our desk, you know, our phones in our hand, and how do we kind of make sense of what's in front of us? And I think there's some really exciting probably opportunities within that, but we have to, you know, worry about the disbenefits of doing it as well, like we talked about.
The other thing I'm hearing about is quantum computing. I don't claim to know much about it at all, but I hear that this could be breakthrough technology that could be the answer to many of these problems. Is there technology like that out there? Are you optimistic about the future?
I think the optimism for today is that actually an awful lot of what we've got and how we connect it together and how we make use of it has enabled us to work in far more flexible ways than we have done previously. And whilst I'm sure that there's been an increase, you know, in our scope 3 emissions now as a result of that, I think back, you know, only just 5 years ago, and I used to drive each way to the centre of Bath every day to get to my desk. Now I do the school run and I walk upstairs. I've lost that commuting challenge that I had, you know, so regularly. And I still do commute in, but I commute in now for reasons to work together and to be harmonious, to engage with the team, to meet, you know, meet customers when I was in those sorts of jobs. And so I think an awful lot of, you know, what we've got now with cloud storage and cloud computing, you know, has really enabled quite a fundamental shift in how many of us work, which I think for well-being point of views and opening up opportunities for people, you know, has been fantastic. But I'll sort of go back to a comment I made a while ago that like for like, it's a lot better, you know, doing from an energy point of view. You know, so I'm definitely saving, you know, tons and probably kilos and kilos and kilos of you know, carbon every single time I don't drive into Bath, which is great, in particularly over the course of a whole year. The downside comes, though, when we start to do things in the environment that we wouldn't have done previously. So running a massive AI engine over, you know, all my documents to find the one thing that I'm looking for, you know, that can be quite an efficient, from an energy point of view, you know, way of doing something. You know, if it was something I was going to do anyway, and this can find the result much, much, much faster, then actually that's probably a really good use of, you know, AI and technology. If we're starting to, say, run models of things, maybe it's part of analysis of something that we're designing. Well, there probably was an option that we could run it, you know, on our servers back in the office. And maybe we would have said, well, it's going to take a long time. So we'll just run a fairly low fidelity model for maybe a couple of days. Actually, the moment we put it into the cloud, maybe we've now got access to 10 times, 100, 1,000 times more capacity. Oh, so do I run my model at low fidelity that would have taken, you know, 2 days in 10 minutes? Or do I maybe go, well, I'm happy for it to take 2 days. What I'll do now, I'll run a really high fidelity model. This will be great. It'll look amazing. It'll give some really great insights. And the imagery at the end of it will be, you know, fantastic. Right. But actually, I've now used up, you know, maybe it hasn't cost me any more money because our on-premises infrastructure was quite expensive. But now maybe I've now used up a whole load more processing time and energy and electricity doing something which hasn't taken me any longer, but I wasn't capable of doing it beforehand. And I think that this is where, like, the opportunity around particularly sort of AI and things, we need to be quite mindful that if we just enable lots of models to run all the time, they will absolutely use an awful lot of energy up. And that's, from an AI perspective, is where a lot of energy gets used in creating the model at the outset. And so as we look at new technologies, a lot of the technologies are focused on how do we do that bit simpler? How do we kind of grow? How do we build the model faster? How do we find the answer to the problem, whatever that problem is, in the shortest amount of time possible? Because You know, that ultimately means that maybe you can get more users to use whatever you're doing, but also it probably uses less electricity, it probably has less of an environmental impact. And so quantum technology, quantum computing will be transformative in some areas, and it will be in other areas, it just won't make a particular impact on your day-to-day life. So if you're doing a lot of computational modeling, like maybe fluid mechanics or DNA sequencing or something where you've probably got to crunch through the same problem an awful lot of times, then quantum computing should be a very efficient way of doing that. But it may also allow you to solve problems that you couldn't solve in a conventional way. And so, yes, it may well be absolutely brilliant, but I guarantee you that people will start to solve problems that they couldn't solve previously because it would have taken a million
that
years.
That much longer.
Or an unrealistically long amount of time to complete.
But I think what's clear is that technologies like AI give us this increased ability to process information, but also remembering that that comes with responsibility. I think just because we can run more detailed data models or complex calculations that we couldn't do before, it doesn't always mean that we should. And I think we should be considering all the options that are available to us. And we do need to be mindful of the environmental costs. So join Simon, Dow and I for part two, and we'll shift to the ethical questions and take a closer look at the human side of digital transformation.